So a podcaster walks into a bar in Cabo San Lucas. He's got three microphones, a ferret down his trousers, and enough bourbon and prophylactics to last all summer long. And he's got a...
Sometimes I do need to get away from it all.
But what are you getting away from?
Life. Podcasting. Reading all these books.
I know it adds up.
Maybe I should check into one of these cottages.
What?
There's a cottage industry of cottages. The cottages help you to get away from it all.
Do they serve cottage cheese?
Sometimes, if you ask politely.
But what if you live in a cottage? I mean, if you're in a cottage and you need to get away from it all, you can't get away to a cottage to get away from it all.
Then you'd need to get away from it all to get away from it all.
Or perhaps... get away from it all, to get away from it all, to get away from it all.
Max can explain.
So I am here with C. Max McGee of The Millions to talk about his nomination for the LBC Spring 2007 pick, The Cottagers.
So, hello.
Hi, Max. So I was wondering if you can tell me a little bit about, I know you get so many books that come through your door. What attracted you to The Cottagers?
Well, I actually discovered the book. I was talking with my good friend Garth, who now writes for The Millions fairly frequently, and we often talk about books. And he was telling me about this book. He was actually a student of Marshall's. Marshall Quimus Whiskey, at Washington University when he was an undergrad several years ago. And so we were just talking about different books that we'd read in the last few months, and he was saying that, you know, this old teacher of his had written this really great book and that, you know, it hadn't gotten all that much attention and that I should check it out. So eventually I got around to it, and I read it, and I really liked it, and I was... like Garth, I was really surprised that I hadn't really heard that much about it. I mean, it's a debut novel. A new book by an unknown writer doesn't get as much attention, but, you know, it was definitely a book that I really enjoyed, and so I wanted to tell more people about it.
So let's talk about the book a little bit. It's set on an island off the coast of British Columbia in Canada?
Yeah, it's on Vancouver Island and sort of on a out-of-the-way sort of nook, a little off the beaten path, and it's sort of these academic yuppie types, and they're trying to get away and go on this not really extravagant vacation, but the sort of vacation that I think a typical working person would not embark on. So they sort of show up in this little town called East Sook and have rented a cottage, and so they're the Cottagers from the title.
And it's sort of their encounters with one particular group or one person who's a native islander and sort of the people around
him.
Yeah,
the book opens with from the point of view of Cyrus, who's a 19-year-old, and he's I guess what you would call a townie, a local. And he's sort of peeking through the bushes at these new people showing up. And you know, from there, right at that point, you get this sort of off-kilter feeling, and I don't know, it's interesting. You know, on the one hand, it sort of feels like it's going to be sort of this novel of relationships about these academic types with their problems and all that, but you know, right from the start, he's thrown in this real wild card character, Cyrus, who is both innocent in one sense, and on the other hand, is very conniving, and he both hates these people for intruding on his little town, but he also envies them incredibly and wants, you know, wishes they could take him away. So it's sort of that is sort of the central conflict, and events sort of transpire out of that tension with this very peculiar young man named Cyrus.
And the author does, like, sort of hop between points of view. Like, we start with Cyrus, and then we hop into the mind of, by alternating chapters, to each of the people, that each of the cottagers there. And so in terms of craft, I was impressed at sort of that achievement and sort of having this collage of your allegiances, because I found myself sort of moving, siding with one person or another and having that allegiance shift. And I was wondering, are there other Any other craft elements that attracted you to the book or made you want to nominate it?
Well, I thought that was definitely came to mind, what you just brought up, the sort of shifting of point of view, but also I just thought it was really well crafted plot wise, a real terrific building of tension. You know, the novel really from the start has this sort of, he's imbued it with this feeling of unease. All is not going to go well, you feel like, but you really have no idea why or what's going to happen. And also he brings into it a terrific sense of place. This novel is very much rooted in where it takes place, in this little out-of-the-way town.
That in some ways is almost like the end of the world.
Yeah, it really does. It really feels like, you know, the two of the characters, one of the couples has driven from Brooklyn all the way, you know, as part of their sort of extravagant vacation, they've driven from Brooklyn all the way across the continent to this little town. And it really does feel like if you just kept driving, you know, from New York City, eventually the road would give out and this is where it would end up. And it definitely has that feeling. And it's, you know, it's also the kind of place where, not that this is a horror novel or anything like that, but it's sort of the sense that, like, you know, if you screamed, nobody would hear you because it's just so out of the way in the middle of nowhere.
Like you said, I think there are some twists and turns in the plot that took me by surprise, even though I had the, like you said, a feeling of unease, even from the first mm-hmm. pages. So I don't want to give too much away. But what mm-hmm. would you say to someone who hadn't read the book yet to tell them why they should read it?
Well, I think it's a book that sort of surprises you. That's sort of easy to write off initially, even though you do meet Cyrus right away, who's definitely like the heart of this book. The other characters sort of, you know, I think it's possible to feel that they are a little bit trite and frustrating because they are these sort of ripped from a New Yorker story characters with their, you know, problems that we all wish we had because their lives seem so, you know, so relatively easy. But I think that, I guess in recommending it, you know, you've got these, it's a book that surprises you, I guess. You really don't know. It's got some great twists and turns that aren't telegraphed, and like you said, we don't want to give away what happens because there's some pretty great twists and turns, and the ending is just sort of astonishing, I felt like. That's how I would bill it to somebody, that it's a book that will surprise you for sure.
Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you want to say about the book?
I think that's probably good for now. I mean, I hope that, you know, over the course of the week that we've discussed the book, some of the stuff, some other great stuff comes up. There's, you know, things about sort of unlikable characters and you know, how a reader can sort of become attracted to an unlikable character just based on how well the author has presented him and things like that. I think for now that's a pretty good little introduction to the rest of this podcast. So.
Okay. So, thanks.
I go out to work on Monday morning.
Okay, so I'm here with Marshall Klimaszewski, author of The Cottagers, which has been nominated for the Lit Blog Co-op this quarter. Marshall, how are you doing?
I'm great, Ed. Thanks.
First off, I wanted to sort of talk about how this book came about. Cyrus sort of strikes me as this rather interesting cross between Raskolnikov and Lenny from Of Mice and Men with elements of Holden Caulfield put in there. Was he designed to kind of nestle into this great literary tradition of guilt-ridden... without actually giving away the book here.
Yeah, you know, he's certainly where the book began. And in fact, the rest of the book was built around him, in effect. And I guess like a lot of things I've written, it did begin with his voice, although it's a third person attached, but in effect, his mind on the page, I suppose. But I think he's somebody who is... partly coming from me to a certain extent, partly from my experience of having been a local in a place like where Souk, where the book is set, and partly just that other that that I've always found myself writing about, and that is generally somebody who I don't quite understand, but I'm interested in.
You mentioned
a lot more proactive, let's say, in a lot of ways, good and bad, than I certainly ever was as a 19-year-old, and a lot more courageous, even if he probably doesn't have. He's pretty unappealing in a lot of ways, too.
So I'm going to aver something here. I guess it seems to me that Cyrus is almost kind of drawn from your 19-year-old self, and the Cottagers are drawn perhaps from your more recent self. Would this be something to actually...
Yeah, sort of, yeah.
Yeah, it's sort of like you compartmentalize different life experiences and kind of invent it off those.
Yeah, I think that's basically true, yeah. I mean, I know that I do feel spread among them. I hope I'm not really like any of them. But yeah, that was true to a certain extent. The odd thing for me, and I don't know why this is, but is that I found Cyrus so much easier to write. Even though I don't think I'm, a writer with a really terrific memory, and so therefore I don't have this great sense of exactly what it was like to be 19 or to live inside my own 19-year-old mind. And yet he was so much easier for me to write than the Cottagers, who demographically are much closer to me and to people I know. And yet I had a terrible time making them seem to come alive or feel credible in some way in my mind.
Well, that's interesting. Is it possible that the distance of, say, roughly about 15, 20 years of memory here that allowed you to kind of, I guess, approach Cyrus with a fresh eye? Or were these Cottagers, not so pleasant to write?
Yeah, well, that's true. And in fact, they became more pleasant the further I wrote it. More unpleasant, rather. Yeah, I think there's just something about that for me as a writer, at least. And I know some of my favorite writers are maybe at the obvious opposite end of the spectrum, but... something about having the unknown be as significant a portion of what's going into the mix for a character as experience or memory or other things closer to home that just makes it easier. I guess in a way it's also the few times I've ever tried and I've never been successful to really write a character who was truly and fairly directly based on somebody I knew. I just had it became clearer than ever to me how few things, even a really complex, well-made character, is built out of relative to an actual lived life, if it's a person you know well. Mm-hmm. And so that process of selecting and constantly being aware of what's being left out that would actually, make the portrait more true or more interesting, that happens when you're writing from experience, I find that more limiting than having empty spots that I can imagine my way into, I think.
Well, there's also a noted disparity between the Cottagers and the Sioux natives, because there's Canadian versus American, there's blue collar versus white collar, there are different expertises of knowledge, and I'm wondering, did you kind of need this sort of, almost dichotomy here in order to kind of keep the narrative shift of this book continuing, or?
Yeah, to a certain extent, definitely. I mean, Laurel is one of the Cottagers and is probably the least likable and the most manipulative. And she, her role increased and her nastiness increased as I was writing the book, because I recognized that I needed her to keep some things moving along and to stir these people up to a certain extent when Cyrus wasn't busy doing that. But it's also, I think, true, just something that came out of the origins of the novel. As I say, I grew up in a part of Connecticut where I was the local, and there were a lot of New Yorkers who had second homes in our area. So I was on the other side of that sort of cottager relationship. And the first time I was in Sooke on Vancouver Island, where the book is set, my wife and I, it was the first sabbatical I've ever had. And although we didn't go there with a couple of friends, my wife and I did go and rent a cottage for several months into the off-season in this really beautiful place. But it was my first time ever being on the other side of that particular relationship. We had traveled before, but we'd never had the money or the sort of opportunity to really do a longer stay like that. And it was just bringing up a lot of reminding me of a lot of things that I had long forgotten about being the local, and also strange to be on the other side of the equation. I found myself having a sort of cottager's fear of the woods and of ruralness and of isolation and all sorts of ways that I just thought was hilarious as a kid when we were encountered among the New Yorkers, you know.
Wow. So it sounds to me like it may have been difficult for you to write the cottager's perspective simply because these were bringing up really terrible feelings here.
Yeah, well, in a way, maybe that's true, yeah. I mean, I think there are, you know, the cottagers maybe, or at least to my mind, who knows, but run along a certain spectrum of likability. There's another character named Samina who I think of as, you know, a more appealing part of the book, or a more appealing character, and maybe the sort of sympathetic center of it. Although, for me, Cyrus is that, and that's been a really interesting thing about publishing the book and speaking to readers, is the range of responses that Cyrus gets. You know, he's somebody I came to really like and feel for, despite the fairly terrible mistakes he makes along the way in the writing of it. But that certainly hasn't been true for every reader.
Well, I have to also ask about the constable and his mini-mounties. He's certainly the oddest character in the book. Did you need his presence to kind of shake the kind of polar extremes between the locals and the cottagers up? Or?
I don't know. You know, I doubt I actually needed his presence at all, unfortunately. And in fact, I certainly, there was an early stage at which my editor, you know, did as much as she could to cut him out of the book, or wished that he would be. But, you know, I had fun writing him, had fun using him as a way to kind of play with the ways in which the book is very, very vaguely maybe a sort of mystery novel, and therefore have a kind of a detective, but, you know, in the only way that I really knew how to do such a thing. But I also, in a way, he was born more out of prior reading, because I feel like the books and authors that I've loved from somebody like George Eliot or something up to an Alice Munro story or something like that, it always seems to me that there's some point, especially in novels, although in a really good, you know, long story writer like that as well, where you think you sort of know the size and the terms of the project, and then they'll just open a sort of back door that you hadn't realized was there, and you'll step into a whole new room and have just a sense of it going in a direction you hadn't anticipated. And I just had always thought that if I ever succeeded in writing a novel, I had tried to write a couple before this, I would try and take advantage of that, which always seemed like something that I personally couldn't figure out how to do in a short story.
Well, that's precisely what... Oh, yeah, I was just going to say that's exactly what Max McGee, who nominated this book, observed in his post, that the book started off as this book about relationships and then becomes this sort of psychological thriller. Do you, for a novel, because you've also done some short fiction, do you need to have this kind of ever-shifting nature of what the narrative is in order to keep keep both the reading audience and yourself as author occupied pleasantly, or...?
I guess so. You know, really, for me, writing a novel, that does seem to like an essential difference with a novel that rather than a short story. I think I've mostly thought of short stories as something that where you can have a certain set of a constellation of interests or ideas or things bothering you, and you can sort of have them all in hand at the beginning of the composition and just see sort of how many different ways you can turn them over and expose different facets along the way, and then the story's done. And a novel, you know, I have the sense at least of, although I know certain exceptions of this with sort of wonderful short novels, but mostly it seems like they require some kind of more complex structure. And my feeling, especially in failing to finish several novels that I got pretty far in before this, was always that... that not being able to hold it all in my head and having it sort of spiral out in other directions was something that was both exciting and ultimately, you know, ran the whole thing into the ground. And so it was a aspect to this book that I couldn't help but do. I don't think I know how to write without doing that sort of thing, without having things sort of I don't think I'm a very controlled writer. Mm. But at the same time, I did it in fear as well.
I have to ask, was Patricia Highsmith an influence on this book? Because that's a similarly kind of people in leisure being interrupted by unexpected young
people.
Yeah, I was wondering if that had occurred to you.
No, I have since read Patricia Highsmith because, in fact, I read her when I first got connected to this editor at Norton who ended up taking the book because she mentioned Patricia Highsmith as somebody she thought of as related, and now I love her. I'm getting addicted, but I hadn't read her before.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, how did this book get to Norton, as a matter of fact? I wanted to ask.
Well, you know, it's really sort of my second book, although, you know, they're publishing the collection, the first book, after it.
Oh, great.
Because I think just that I had had this collection of stories that have been done for years, and couldn't find a publisher, as is, you know, true for so many collections. And so it was the usual thing of just needing to finish a novel before somebody was going to take the collection. And as I said, I've been working on this other novel before this one that had gotten far enough along. It was sort of two-thirds done that my agent had wanted to and had shown it to a couple of editors. But they had only rejected it, saying exactly the sorts of things, which hasn't happened to me often, but they would say, put their finger on exactly the sorts of things that I knew and suspected were its terrible failings. And so I gave that one up, and I ended up, Norton took it because I think this editor there had read a couple of stories and liked them in the past. So I think she was perhaps sort of predisposed to be interested in what I would do with the novel, and happily did end up liking it. But it went out to a few different several places before landing at Norton as well.
Okay. We'll keep that mysterious, I suppose. But I actually, though, you know, I'm glad that the short story collection is coming out because I actually wanted to ask you. I had noticed that you had written a story in Plowshares called Snowfield, which takes place over a single train ride. And this was, and I wanted to read it, and unfortunately it wasn't available online. And to actually, you know, find this back issue would, you know, be a considerable pain.
Yeah.
But I do want to ask you about this because all the chapters in this book are these sorts of protracted scenes of particularly like between the constable and Samina, you know, that whole phone call exchange. Do you find that the protracted scene is the best way for you to kind of allow this narrator to happen? Because these characters, I mean, you know, don't really move from their various locations throughout the book. They're kind of stuck there in one constant location, and I found that to be quite interesting.
Yeah, that's interesting. Now I'd have to look back, but I don't think I've written in particularly protracted scenes in short stories as often. I think I've tended to have a kind of mix of scene and summary and, you know, the usual. And, yeah, it may be that just something about this particular book lent itself to that especially. The way that the cottagers are there by choice and want to sort of settle in, and the nature of being a cottager as opposed to some other kind of more short-term tourist where you to a certain extent sort of take on somebody else's life and pretend for a little while that it's yours or that you could be living that life. Or at least that's what I do, what I found myself doing when I was there.
Mm-hmm.
That combined with the locals' feeling of, which always seems to involve a certain amount of feeling trapped and feeling as though you'll never get out, made a bit of claustrophobia feel like it was something for that book. But I didn't intend to be writing in sort of those kinds of protracted scenes, and they just sort of ended up there.
Well, I suppose it has something to do with what you're describing here. When you go on vacation and you really don't know what to do with yourself, particularly since these characters are very much talking about their work as opposed to personally connecting with each other. And it's also really interesting in light of the fact that this, you know, your own trip to Souk was your first sabbatical yourself.
Yeah.
I have to ask, I mean, you know, maybe this is the nature of being stuck in one spot, that you're sort of stuck in terms of, you know, okay, well, how do I personally connect to these particular, you know, the locals, or what is my purpose here? I have no work. And this seemed to me a running theme throughout the book. I actually had another question relating this, and maybe we can tie this larger issue into a long answer of some kind. But yeah. The location, location, location. You have Samina longing for India throughout and not able to get there because her husband Nicholas won't take her there. I'm wondering if you might be able to talk about the relationship here between this personal revelation that is restricted by staying in one spot and traveling or being migratory to some degree.
Well, yeah, that's a really interesting question. I think I was thinking a lot about, you know, as I was writing the book, I'm not a writer who, I don't know what I'm writing a book about as I started, in terms of both plot and event, and I think, you know, what it is I want to say or something like that. I've never found I'm able to have things set out in advance like that, for better or worse, and usually for worse, it seems like. But as I was writing the book, it seemed to me that I was finding myself writing about the discrepancy between the lived life and all of the versions of that life that sort of trail after it, and therefore also about, I think most of those versions exist in the people we're encountering, the discrepancies between the perceived events and what actually happens, or the ways that sometimes perhaps our lives are built out of reactions to things that we have in some important way misperceived. And all of that started to seem sort of related to, as I say, this kind of in-betweenish travel, where you are going to this other place and you've presumably chosen it because it's exotic to compared to your home and feels, you know, beautiful and interesting in certain ways. But at the same time, you're going there to really settle in and to imagine that you might stay. It's funny, in an earlier draft, Greg, one of the cottagers, actually got to think for a while. I think it might momentarily still happen in the final draft, but got to think for a while that he was going to just live in Zouk and move there. And,
really?
That was something that I guess I was interested in how I've had that experience a little bit, and I've always felt when I've come back home, because of course it's never actually happened, that it just seems so foolish, you know, that I was attracted to exactly what would make that a place that I couldn't really call home. And as soon as it began to feel like home, of course, I'd be attracted to someplace else. And I mean, in a way, this is all fairly simple, but I did get really interested in that, and in the way that relates to the life that is there beside you, that you are attracted to and find yourself sort of trying to semi-step into, as mainly Cyrus does with the cottagers, with all of his spying on them and then insinuating himself into their lives.
Well, it's also that the occupations of all the characters are not necessarily contingent upon their location. You know, biography can be, you know, you could write a biography anywhere, pretty much, that has a library. You know, you can crab anywhere. And that's one of the things that's interesting to me about this book, this notion of people getting away from established locations. And then, of course, you have, you know, the globetrotting near the end of the book. It's almost as if...
Yeah, right, with India too.
Yes, exactly. And so I'm wondering if this was a question on your mind as thematically, you were sort of dwelling upon this notion of this ridiculous idea of how we sort of root ourselves in location and tie it into vocation in a way that is really sometimes quite silly, you know?
Yeah, that's interesting to me. Yeah, definitely. And with India and Samina and that character, I mean, I think I had a sense of that too, that you know, the way in which for a person like that, and she is, I mean, let's face it, she's Indian and Muslim because my wife is Indian and Muslim.
Oh, interesting.
But in, you know, through that, the experience of being with her, it's always been striking to me the way to be a person, this is certainly not true for me here in America, but it was when we went to India, a person who is first and foremost being placed and encountered as an exotic of some kind and as a person who represents something in the distance. Mm-hmm. in which she's constantly being perceived and misperceived by and interpreted by the various people around her in the book, being somewhat akin to what Cyrus feels that they're all doing about him and that cottagers in generally do about him and his place in some way, which is not exactly answering your question. But I agree with you that I think that there is a weird way in which the light in the distance and the actual lived life can blend so much more easily and readily than we perhaps tend to recognize at certain points in our lives. And that becomes even clearer when you know, living with an immigrant and think about sort of immigrant experience. And even for me, you know, personally, comparing her parents and mine, and they're different takes on the States in certain ways.
Sorry to interrupt, but I mean, interestingly, Samina is the only one who has any kind of introspective abilities about what's going on. I mean, really, the issue here is not necessarily, you know, I mean, vacations and going to exotic locations, that's fantastic. The problem is that these characters don't know how to live in these places. The disparity that kickstarted this book, you know, they can't really reach out to the Souk locals, which causes this, you know, the problem midway through the book to occur, you know?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think there's so often that feeling of can't reach out and also, you know, not quite interested that, I mean, at some point Cyrus gets, you know, sort of thinks that all he really is to them, cottagers in general, is a kind of smudge on the front of a pretty landscape, you know. And in a way, I guess I've always had that sense that it's not nearly as egregious as it is to Cyrus, I think, by his perception. But at the same time, that, you know, a lot of traveling for many of us, me included, involve encounters with people that are so essentially shallow and full of misperceptions of various kinds, even when the thing that you think you're doing there is partly getting to know what it's like to live here and what the locals, you know, what it's like to crab and things like that.
Well, it seemed also, I mean, you know, here in San Francisco, if you're a local, as I am, you go to Fisherman's Wharf and it's just, you know, that's just inconceivable because you just see these kinds of pre-patterned kind of tour guides. It's just, you're hitting all the exact notes that are nevertheless exotic for some people who haven't been to the city. But I don't know, for me, it's a lot more fun to just go and wander around a city and talk to the locals. And this kind of thing is, you know, obviously, the characters do try this. I mean, Cyrus does enter into their lives, but I found it to be really interesting that the daughter reacts to Cyrus more than anybody else and falls, you know, madly in love with him. It's almost as if it's this kind of lost childhood. These adult characters are so caught up in, you know, in their careers that they have lost this, you know, this innocence of just kind of, you know, innocuously introducing yourself to people and hoping that they'll come by, you know?
Yeah. I think that's right, yeah.
Okay, well, so sorry, I don't want to, this is about you, not me, I'm sorry.
No, not at all.
Yeah, but, well, let's talk about this. There was a review of this book. I was actually surprised because I was looking around for coverage, and Stephen Hayton reviewed this in the New York Times Book Review, and he said that one of the strengths of this book lies in your willingness to create a cast of characters who are unlikable in very human ways and who become less sympathetic as their story unfolds. Now, I wanted to wonder about this. While you were writing this book, did you find yourself resisting these inner temptations to make these characters likable and sympathetic, or...?
No, a little more. For me, the opposite. That I kept worrying about how relatively unsympathetic they might be, and fearing that they were probably even more unsympathetic to or would be to a lot of readers than they were to me. And at the same time, finding my temptations were all to just, you know, push them further. I guess I'm interested in that whole thing, and I absolutely understand the desire to have characters you can identify with and feel deeply sympathetic for. And certainly, you know, some of my favorite reading experiences have involved that experience. But at the same time, I think more often I find myself attracted to books that have deeply flawed characters, you know, who I like despite. And so I think really that is one of those ways in which I've become a writer who I just find myself writing such characters. It's really not intentional, but I have a feeling it's because of who I am as a reader first. Mm-hmm. But I know that's a tricky thing, and it certainly was a tricky thing for this book and for trying to sell it out in the world, you know, and I think understandably so.
And one thing we haven't actually mentioned is Ruskin and Dodgson, who form these interesting sort of subject matters on the surface. They kind of, you know, emerge later on. But I how did the Ruskin and Dodgson connection kind of enter into the narrative, as you were writing?
In a really cheap way originally, which is that I was writing this book out of the immediate death of the last book, and that book was a historical fiction. Some of the stories in the collection are historical fiction, so I've been doing that for a little while and really, really enjoy doing it. So I was trying to write this historical novel that was had among the main characters Dodgson and Ruskin and Julia Margaret Cameron and Dickens and others, and it just fell apart. So to begin with, it was simply to grab some little bit of what was back there that somehow seemed as though it may sort of be relevant or could be, or maybe I could find a way in which, as I wrote along, it could work here. And originally there was a lot more. In fact, there was a lot of stuff on Ruskin, including a whole Ruskin chapter in the book that sort of fell away in later drafts. But when I recognized that it seemed like I was writing primarily about that discrepancy between lived lives and recreated or retold lives, that got me more interested in biography and in a person like Dodgson in particular, who, you know, has that strange thing of we don't really know the key thing to knowing how you're supposed to think about his life, whether he's really a pedophile or really some sort of kind of endearing adult who simply found he could only connect with young girls, with pre-adolescent girls, and also that, as the people in the book sort of talk about, I was really interested in his life and the way that he leaves behind just thousands of letters and diaries upon diaries and journals, and through it all, you just have this constant sense of withholding, and that was really interesting.
Well, that's another interesting disparity. The cottagers in your book, don't, you know, they have plenty of things to say on paper, but they don't have anything to say really in conversation.
Yeah.
they rely on, again, on these sort of cultural constructs that, instead of these existential ones that are so joyful, you know? Was this something that you were trying to, you know, design? Did this kind of encourage them? maybe you found yourself like, well, here I am writing a novel about letters and the like, and I deal with these in my real life. let's make these characters more unlikable. I don't know.
I don't think it's something that I had in mind, but yeah, there was some way in which I had this sense of, you know, Cyrus is this character who doesn't connect to and deal with the world with other people on a consistently high level in a way.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I had the sense of him as being kind of gregarious though too, and actually really wanting to connect to people and not having a sense of himself as being incapable or deficient in some way. And somehow it did seem to just sort of end up that it made sense for the cottagers and for various reasons about, you know, their lives and all the things that you're articulating, I think, to be on the other side of that equation, to be people who were perhaps excessively aware of the limits of their ability to contact one another, to have a good conversation, or excessively withholding in terms of emotions and connecting to people, and at the same time to have maybe an excessive investment in all of that and the written page and then more sort of Cyrus himself is very suspicious of.
Well, you also have Cyrus initially, like, I guess midway through the book, he's riffing on the Johnny Cash line, I shot a man in Reno just to see him die.
Yeah, with his Ginny is actually.
Yeah, Ginny. But this seemed to be quite interesting. And then at the end of the book, he's considerably corrupted by this kind of cultural fixation or this kind of clutching on to historical figures in an effort to connect with other people. I was really sort of, you know, I was a bit stunned by this ending because it was sort of like, wow, you know, here's this poor misfit kid who commits a seriously, you know, serious mistake, and yet he is also capable of being co-opted. It seemed to be a rather, you know, startling cynicism from you.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I mean, I hadn't thought about it exactly that way, but I like that, and I see exactly what you mean. I think the other thing, this is much simpler, that I think of as being true of Cyrus is that, you know, he's just powerfully lonely. And a kid who has a really strong sense of encountering, of most of his encounters being shaped by disappointments that he constantly proves to be a disappointment in one way or another to the people who get to know him, and for, you know, from anywhere from his father to just people like the cottagers who only know him briefly. All of that made me have the old, you know, bad novelist's desire to save him just a little, to let him out just a bit of his hole. And at the same time, yeah, I couldn't. It didn't seem right that he would emerge in most ways. And so something about his sort of taking up his father's project, which involved kind of getting to lose yourself into the page a little bit in a way that is even maybe more, you know, isolated and isolating, intentionally isolated than any of the cottagers are involved in. And at the same time, to connect with some people and to get out of Souk, I don't know, there was something about that mix that just seemed like the compromise I came up with in terms of what I wished for from him and thought seemed feasible and what really seems like it would be true to his capabilities.
Gotcha. I'll ask you one last question, and it's really amazing to learn how much of this book came out of your personal experience and how you set the book in locations that are, you know, you've actually been to. And I'm wondering, you know, where do you, as a writer, where does the imagination or the invention aspect jumping off of these personal experiences come from?
Well,
how much is invented, basically?
Yeah, I would sort of say most of it. We went and visited Souk a couple of times, and I tried to stay as true to Souk in a way that doesn't involve people at all as I possibly could. And yet, you know, I certainly didn't meet a Cyrus there. And in fact, we had a perfectly lovely time and weren't haunted by any locals there really at all. So basically all of the events and the cottagers also, they're, you know, there are certain things. I think there's a way in which the certain brands of experience to a certain extent, like the immigrant experience I've spoken about with my wife and my experience with being on both sides of the cottager local thing, kind of, I need to have enough access to those things to feel as though I can go somewhere with a character, but then the people are, you know, are all feel sort of beyond that. They feel all made up, and certainly none of the events that happen in the book actually happen to me or to anyone I know. So it's I think this is the blend that I've often ended up with for some reason of a kind of emotional landscape or territory that that is familiar, but then finding a path through that territory in terms of actual event and even in terms of the way that people think that engages the imagination instead. And for me, it's the imagination has always felt mainly like the leading element for whatever reason.
Gotcha. Well, in Cyrus's case, it's almost that he's living up to the mantra, speak softly and carry a big stick.
Yeah.
But anyway, I had to throw that cheap shot in there. But Marshall, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thanks so much.
Thanks for it.